Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, July 29th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, we're sharing an interview which is part of Rabble's summer Boiling Point series. The Boiling Point examines the ways increasingly high temperatures due to the climate crisis are affecting our summers in Canada on a social, institutional, and ecological level. Today, Rabble's national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel speaks to Dr. Melissa Lem to talk about how the recent wildfires, heat domes, and record-breaking hot temperatures are affecting the physical and mental health of Canadians. A clinic assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Lem also serves as the president-elect of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, or CAPE. Lem first became a member of CAPE when she was still in medical school, and since then she has worked on policy and advocacy campaigns around the climate crisis, including wildfires, active transportation, and the need to connect to nature for health. She and Wenzel dive into how climate change is a health issue and why it's so important for governments, at all levels, to put policies in place to protect people during extreme weather events. Here are Lem and Wenzel in conversation. Take a listen.
Can you tell me a bit about your role with the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment and how you got involved with the group?
I've been a member of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment since I was a medical student and first heard about them because I grew up always concerned about the environment and my family would call me a tree hugger. But it was really only after moving to British Columbia at the end of 2015 and then getting involved with the BC CAPE chapter and then eventually becoming president-elect. I think it's 1.5 years ago now that I became really strongly involved with the organization. And since then, I've done all kinds of different work on policy and advocacy around climate change, wildfires, active transportation, connecting to nature for health, just a wide variety of different issues that concern people in BC and across Canada.
And so what was it about environmental ramifications for health that really drove you to wanting to make a change as a doctor in our environment?
The truth is that only about 20 to 25% of our health status comes from our healthcare system. And so 75 to 80% comes from factors outside many people's control that have to do with the built infrastructure around them or the actual environment that gives rise to that built infrastructure. So if as physicians, as healthcare workers, we want to make sure that our patients have the best health status, we have to start looking beyond our offices and our hospitals. We have to start looking at social determinants of health, at ecological determinants of health, like making sure we have clean air to breathe, healthy temperatures, enough green space and trees to shade us and cool our cities to keep us healthy. So that's why, is because climate change is a health issue. Having healthy environments is a health issue, arguably the greatest health issue, as the World Health Organization has said, the greatest threat to public health of the 21st century. So I've really imbibed that message and through my work with CAPE and otherwise try to make sure that I am working on those ecological determinants of health at the same time as providing care to patients in my own office.
And with all of those kind of factors in mind, how are you applying this stuff in practice with your patients?
So with heat and smoke in particular, this is what we're seeing a lot of on the west coast of BC that is directly impacting patients. Number one, when summer is coming, for the past 2 years now, I guess, since we've had extreme heat or since we've had the heat dome in BC, I make sure that my elderly patients, my patients with chronic disease, and also parents of young kids are well educated about how to stay safe in heat. So that includes doing a medication review to make sure that they know what to do with certain medications when it gets hot out, you know, to wean them down or to even hold some of them and, or make sure they drink more fluids. It involves talking to them about making sure if they can afford it to have air purifiers in their home. So when the wildfire smoke hits, that they can have clean air to breathe indoors. So just a lot of individual level interventions that I speak with patients about, but on a wider level, I'm constantly, along with CAPE, advocating to different levels of government, whether it be the city of Vancouver or provincially or federally, to put in place policies that protect people in their own homes and make our communities safer. So for example, ensuring that there's legislation to make sure that heat pumps will be used in homes to heat and cool them in the summertime, as opposed to natural gas heating, which is driving climate change by burning more fossil fuels. It's also advocating for more street trees and more green spaces to ensure that we don't have more of those urban heat islands that we saw during the heat dome were so deadly for people within the Lower Mainland. And it's also advocating to these different level of governments to put in place policies that reduce burning fossil fuels, which are driving climate change. So it's really the actions that I take span from an individual in-office level with my patients to wider societal change.
Now, what is the consensus among your patients or among patients in general? What are their concerns or fears or, you know, questions of uncertainty around the health-related impacts of extreme heat events?
Do you know what's interesting is I can't say that I've had specific conversations with my own patients about eco-anxiety, for example, or about their anxiety around heat or smoke. But what I have noticed in my own patients is decompensation in mental health around these major extreme weather events. So for example, at the beginning of the pandemic, I thought, okay, I'm going to see a huge wave of mental health concerns because of all the lockdown and the isolation and the fear about what this COVID-19 virus might be. But I didn't see that. In fact, it was only when the extreme smoke rolled in from the wildfires, it was only when the heat hit that my phone lines started lighting up with patients calling in about anxiety and depression and decompensating from a mental health perspective. So I think that really illustrated to me that our own environments can be part of what's causing anxiety and depression. And that really it was these natural weather disasters that pushed my own patients over the edge when it came to their mental health. So again, I haven't had specific conversations about climate change concerns, but I think just the proof is in the pudding in terms of how I saw patterns of calls change for mental health during these extreme weather events.
Talking about climate anxiety and climate grief, you know, I have to wonder if maybe the reason that you're not having these specific conversations is the fact that folks might not be able to articulate or connect all of these things together. I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about climate grief and what your thoughts are on this concept that is starting to come a bit more into the social consciousness.
I think it is a rising concern given how much more aware people are about the effects of climate change on our health and society, and also how many more climate events are happening. It's almost impossible to ignore now. We hear stories about extreme deadly heat in India, in Europe. We had our own experiences with it on the West Coast almost every year. We can smell and see wildfire smoke and hear stories about wildfires and community displacement. So it's impossible to escape now. And so I think with that proof in our faces, it's obviously driving more and more people to be concerned about it. And I especially hear, not in my office in particular, but in the community with the different groups that I work with, concerns from young people, because they feel in many ways, and rightly so, that it's not their fault that this is happening, that it's really the adults, prior generations that have embraced consumerism and burning of fossil fuels that are driving the climate crisis. And so I think this will become increasingly an issue in the future. And there was a major study that was done just last year looking at youth and their concerns about climate change. And it showed that the majority of them were very concerned about climate change and that they were feeling anxious, angry, and depressed about it. And the biggest thing that they were bothered by was not necessarily the effects of climate change itself, but their perception that governments and adults and industry weren't doing enough to deal with it. the fact that they were hearing that this was an emergency on one hand and seeing the effects of climate change in their own communities, but then thinking the people who are supposed to be taking care of us are not actually taking care of us as they should. And so one major way for us to deal with that climate anxiety and help youth, especially who are experiencing it, is for governments to put in place effective policy to not just pay lip service to climate action, but actually put in place policy that will hit the targets that we need, which is a 60% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030 and net zero by 2050. We essentially have to be putting a whole society approach into reducing carbon. And when I think young people and others, parents, can see that this is happening, they'll feel more reassured and we'll have less reason for anxiety.
Now, I just want to shift to talking about who is most at risk of suffering from extreme heat events, but also keeping in mind that the same folks who are at greatest risk during extreme heat events are also the same folks who disproportionately receive substandard healthcare or don't have access to healthcare. There's already barriers facing these folks. The climate crisis is adding new barriers to their access to health. I'm wondering if you could talk about who these folks are and the ramifications it's having.
One of the huge injustices of climate change is that it disproportionately affects people whose health status is already worse. So some of those groups include racialized people, Indigenous people, people with chronic diseases, the elderly, pregnant people, and young children. In many cases, these are people who have done very little to actually cause climate change. Other groups that are included in those would be people who often have outdoor work, people who are unhoused, and people with low income. And the reason heat often affects these people the most is because one reason is because they have lower health status, so their bodies are less physiologically adapted to deal with the effects of heat. But then another reason is, for example, with young children or the elderly or people with chronic disease, their bodies can't respond to the effects of heat as well. Their central nervous systems don't have the same control over their skin or their sweating mechanisms or even their thirst response or their ability to seek out fluids than otherwise healthy adults or older children. So that's what puts them at higher risk. Also, people who are of lower income tend to live in areas of cities where there are less green spaces and less tree cover, and also tend to live in buildings where there isn't air conditioning or heat pumps to be able to cool those buildings. And so we really saw the evidence of those effects during the heat dome, where some of the major factors for death were having low income, were living in buildings without air conditioning or local green space around. I mean, I think the wonderful thing about fighting climate change, and one thing that we really have to keep in mind, is that hopefully the ways in which we do that will also reduce these health inequities that put people at higher risk. So we can't just further entrench health inequities by, you know, giving people, for example, incentives to upgrade their homes when they already live in, you know, multi-million dollar large homes on beautiful tree-lined streets. We also have to focus our efforts on adaptation in low-income neighborhoods and among populations that will and are being most affected by climate change.
Now, Melissa, a few months ago, I spoke with Dr. Kyle Merritt. He's a doctor in BC who was right on scene, having firsthand experience when the heat dome came to Lytton, BC, and saw a record temperature of 49.6 degrees. Celsius. And I spoke to Dr. Merritt because he made headlines for diagnosing a patient as suffering from climate change. What had happened was there was a woman in her 70s who'd come in who was suffering from heat-related illnesses. She had chronic disease, and he didn't diagnose the case specifically as climate change. But what Dr. Merritt did was he recognized that these underlying causes of this woman's health effects could be contributed to climate change. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on something like that, and if you think that we're going to see more cases, more illnesses diagnosed and attached to climate change.
Well, first of all, I know Kyle. He's a colleague of mine, and we work together with BC CAPE, sometimes the BC chapter of CAPE. But absolutely, we are seeing more wildfires. We are seeing more heat events, and more people are making those links. And I just want to say, in terms of what I saw in the Lower Mainland during the heat dome and the wildfires, was more patients with heat illness than I'd ever seen in my entire career. And this spanned the gamut from wicked cases of heat rash, to dehydration, to patients coming in with headaches and weakness that were lasting days after they had heat stroke. And I heard from colleagues in the emergency rooms that those were the worst shifts of their entire careers. And if you think about it, these are colleagues that had been through multiple waves of COVID and had seen patients in respiratory distress. But they described situations to me where they were literally running from room to room, intubating patients who were seizing and unconscious from heat. It was an absolute disaster. And so I think this obviously represents the extreme of what we could see with an unprepared healthcare system and an overtaxed healthcare system in an attempted response to an extreme weather event. But we're going to see more of these if we don't prepare. And absolutely, I think, again, it's unavoidable. We know that, for example, the heat dome was made 150 times more likely because of climate change. So it was almost impossible to happen without it. And again, with more of these extreme weather events, it's going to be impossible to ignore and impossible for healthcare professionals to not make that link.
Now, one other aspect that I think has kind of gotten lost in the mix, but it has at least concerned me quite greatly, is, of course, there's a lot of talk about hitting daytime record high temperatures, but we're also hitting, sometimes more often, record overnight temperatures. And I'm hoping you could talk a little bit about how dangerous record overnight temperatures are when people can't cool off.
Mm-hmm. Often it's the accumulated heat that starts to become a problem. And also when temperature swings dramatically, like when you go from cool weather to suddenly hot weather, our bodies just don't have the time to adapt. So usually our bodies rely on that overnight cooling for our central body temperatures to calm down and to cool down. But with hotter overnights, we just don't have that rest period. Also, when people are hotter overnight, they're restless, they don't sleep as well. And we know that poor sleep is a risk factor for all kinds of other health conditions. So on multiple levels, having the inability to cool down in the moment and also affecting our cognition in the short term are both ways that hot overnight temperatures can interfere with our health.
Now, I want to open the conversation up to more physical, emotional, social, and psychological harms that come with surviving and living through extreme heat events. We're talking about things from losing your home and being displaced, losing your livelihood, losing loved ones. Can you talk a bit about and go through what some of these, the greatest health ramifications are when we're talking about extreme heat events?
That's a good question. I think with heat events, a lot of the effects are short term. Like you get into an extreme medical situation where you get dehydrated or you get heat stroke and you have to seek immediate medical care. And then a lot of those episodes, unfortunately, are reflected in death statistics. So we saw during the heat dome, the latest statistics say that over 600 people died as a direct result of the heat dome and heat illness. But something that's not often tallied are heat injuries. And it's been estimated that at least 10 heat injuries happen for every episode of heat mortality during the heat dome. So these are cases that are not necessarily being tracked. I think an acute episode of heat can, for example, permanently damage your kidneys. It can cause, in some cases, damage to your brain. And it can also, obviously, from the trauma that happens from that medical situation, cause mental health concerns. So I don't know that there has been much study done on long-term effects of specific heat episodes on the human body or health, but certainly acute episodes of heat can cause immediate damage to different organs in your body. And people may have to live with the consequences of that long-term.
Pulling from the same findings that you were talking about with over 600 people dying as a result of the heat dome, 98% of those deaths occurred indoors. Only 2% of the folks who died during the heat dome died outside. What are your thoughts on that?
We have to consider indoor cooling a human right. It was only in the 20th century that indoor heating and indoor plumbing became standard. We need to make sure that indoor cooling is standard now to keep people safe. And I think it also speaks to how we need to think about cooling equipment as essential medical equipment, especially for people who have been identified as high risk, like those who are elderly or more isolated or have chronic diseases, because we will see more deaths if people don't have access to cool indoor air. And I think it also speaks to how people didn't realize at the time how serious the heat was. the West Coast is known for being temperate, especially in the Lower Mainland. We have these beautiful, sunny, not overly hot summers typically. So I don't think many people, including the government and the healthcare system, were aware of how deadly it could be. We had some warnings that were put out, but I don't think many people took them seriously because we often hear, oh yeah, heat is coming, great, we'll go to the beach. But I don't think people understood the magnitude of it. I feel like the government, the healthcare system, and everyday people have woken up now, and there are mechanisms being put in place to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again with the next heat event. But again, I think it speaks to how we need to see our healthcare system as beyond just what we do in our own healthcare system, but also extends to green infrastructure and cooling in homes, and especially cooling mechanisms that don't worsen climate change by burning more fossil fuels.
Now, just one other question I'd like to ask you, Melissa. We're talking about healthcare, and in Canada, healthcare makes up nearly 5% of all carbon emissions. So these emissions result in about 23,000 years of life lost every year due to disability or early death. I'm wondering, as we push the federal government to make changes and to adapt to the climate crisis, I'm wondering if you have any suggestions or recommendations on how the healthcare system can also adapt.
Oh, that's a big question, and that requires some big brains. But I think one absolutely essential part is to make sure that we have a strong functioning primary care system. And this is something that has been neglected for too long, is often family doctors are not necessarily prioritized as much in funding as other medical specialties. And what we have to remember is that when people show up in the emergency room, when they show up in the OR to have a cancer operated on, or when they show up to the respirologist with COPD because they've been exposed to smoke or air pollution long term, many of these cases could have been prevented upstream by strong primary care and having a family physician following them and screening them to make sure that their chances of illness are lower. So that's one thing I think we need to recognize. I think we also, I mean, there's so many different things we could do, but we need to start tracking our healthcare emissions. Right now, there's no national or really provincial mechanism in place to actually figure out how much the supply chains, how much the operations of each hospital and healthcare authority are contributing to carbon. And if you don't track something, you can't manage it. And so I think it's, again, that's something that we're trying to push for as part of CAPE, is better tracking of carbon emissions. And then, for example, another thing that's important is national pharmacare, for example, to make sure that when we prescribe medications to keep people healthy, that they have access to them and can take them. Really, anything that builds resilience into the population will help with overall health outcomes. And then, of course, cutting down on single-use items, reducing unnecessary use of plastic, just, again, matching supply to demand of health of our healthcare system is really important overall to make sure that we're not overusing, but also that we have enough resources in place to keep our population healthy.
That was a conversation between Rabble's Stephen Wenzel and Dr. Melissa Lem of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Thank you very much for that, Stephen and Melissa. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to Rabble's editor, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, Pope Francis visited Canada to apologize to Indigenous peoples for the Catholic Church's role in residential schools. Cindy Blackstock is an Indigenous activist for child welfare and executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. Beyond an apology, Blackstock recommends 8 ways the Catholic Church can ensure this apology has meaning in her article written in response to the Pope's visit this week. There is still time to ensure this apology has meaning, she writes. The First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children who attended residential schools and suffered so deeply, and those who died there, deserve this and more. In health and wellness news, Stephen Wenzel reports on a coalition of organizations who are calling on the federal government to meet their promised funding goals for those living with HIV. The recommendations that came from the House Standing Committee back in 2003 were to spend $100 million per year to respond to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. The same recommendation was issued again in 2019. The coalition, dubbed National Advocates, is made up of the Community-Based Research Center and 18 other organizations, including the HIV Legal Network. On top of asking for adequate funding, the National Advocates are also advocating for governments to better engage with people living with HIV and organizations supporting them. Jody Jalimore, the executive director of the Community-Based Research Center, says that Canada's HIV response is stuck in the past and believes that part of the reason that the HIV/AIDS pandemic doesn't receive adequate attention is because people aren't dying from the disease in the same rates as in the 1980s and 90s. However, data shows that the crisis continues, disproportionately impacting communities that already face barriers to the country's healthcare system. As of 2018, more than 62,000 people in Canada were living with HIV, with roughly 8,300 people, or 13%, unaware of their status. Also this week, the restriction of abortion rights affects us all, not just those who can get pregnant, argues Leah Thompson on behalf of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada. She writes, "Having the dignity and right to choose your own path in life should not be threatened or imposed by a policymaker. It's time for all genders to tell their pro-choice stories and stand up for this human right." Finally, great news. After a successful second season, Courage My Friends will be returning to our sister podcast, Needs No Introduction, this September. For those who don't know, Courage My Friends is a series which dives into the complexities of living within the convergence of COVID, capitalism, and the climate crisis. In our second season, host Resh Boudou and guests explore topics such as critical pedagogy and education, climate anxiety and climate grief, challenging billionaire wealth, and much more. Tune in to Needs No Introduction on Spotify or Apple Podcasts to listen to all new Courage My Friends episodes now, and join us again in September. Courage My Friends is presented by Rabble.ca, the Tommy Douglas Institute at George Brown College, and the Douglas Coldwell Layton Foundation. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. The last thing we'd like to share with you listeners is this. For 21 years, the Rabble community has fought for transformative change together. Amid our summer fundraiser, Libby Davies shares how Rabble's events continue to unify progressive audiences.
Hello, my name's Libby Davies. I'm very happy that I can participate as a co-host with Robin Brown of Rabble's Off the Hill, which is a monthly national forum to bring together activists, academics, people who are working on issues of concern to us all to host a discussion about what's going on. We have audience participation and we have lively discussion. So it's a great space to bring people together to hear about what's going on. And so to do that monthly and for Rabble to allow that space to happen and to foster it and facilitate it is one of the great things that Rabble does.
Off the Hill is free and accessible for all, but it takes time and work to coordinate. Become a monthly Rabble supporter today to ensure Off the Hill brings progressives together for years to come. Visit rabble.ca/donate for more information. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.